I love this study. It's very intriguing. This is by Dr. Keltner, who's a psychologist at the University of California, Berkeley, and he studies the nature of awe, or the power of awe, A-W-E, which he thinks is a sort of neglected and understudied positive emotion. And what he's found is that when people perceive awe or experience awe, they behave in a more generous fashion. And one of the ways he showed this is he took some students into a grove of tall trees on the University of California campus, tall eucalyptus trees. And he had these students look at the trees for just 1 minute. And then a similar group of students looked at a tall building on campus instead. And a researcher during these trips supposedly accidentally, but really on purpose, spilled a box of pens. And they just measured how many pens the subjects helped pick up. How helpful were they? And it turns out that they were more helpful after looking at the trees than after looking at the building. So it looks like, among other things, awe actually makes us behave more generously.
I love that experiment. It makes me want to take my kids outside, make them stare
Absolutely.
At trees,
take them out
to the kitchen, see if they're going to help with the dishes. You open the book with a description of using an app on your phone to map your happiness. And this app, called Mappiness, it sets off another thread in the book, and that is the both incredible benefit and incredible bane of technology in our lives. Summarize your ultimate takeaway. You are a mother of children. You live in a big city. You need technology, I'm guessing, all day, every day. Where did you fall at the end of your research on the role of everyday technology?
I think you're right. There was a dismaying quality to the beginning of the book, because the Mappiness app showed me that despite the fact that I think of myself as being someone who, you know, likes to get outside, I was actually caught outside over the course of a year. This app sort of measured where I was. I was only outside like 7% of my day. And 93% of my day, and this is true of really most Americans, you know, 95% of the time we're indoors or we're in a car, which is sort of appalling. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, of course, we need technology. We need to be able to work. We have jobs. Technology has made our lives, you know, wonderful and easy in so many ways. But what we've lost sight of is how profoundly disconnected we've become from nature. And we are a species that evolved in nature. Our brains are set up to behave a certain way and work a certain way because of these interactions it has with the natural world. And when we cut that off, you know, some wiggy things can start happening to our brains and our bodies.
In the course of this book, you experience so many different people and experiences. If you had to pick one that was the most powerful, that sticks with you, which one would it be, Florence?
Well, I think, you know, in this book, I make an effort not just to interview scientists, but to interview real people who are being helped by the natural world. And I was, I think, probably most struck by the week I spent in the wilderness in Idaho with a group of women veterans who were suffering from PTSD. And it was so powerful for me to just watch them kind of come out of their shells over the course of this week on the river. It was just a beautiful thing to see. They formed friendships, which is something that nature facilitates. They had, you know, positive social interactions. They were able to support each other. They reported that they were sleeping like they had not slept in many, many years. They were kind of feeling their bodies again and using their senses in ways that had been sort of cut off for them partly because of all the medications they were taking. And they weren't leaving their houses in some cases. And so just to see them kind of, you know, blossom in this environment was really amazing and powerful.
And at least one of them at the end reported that it wasn't for her. Discuss that small portion, or I don't know how small it is. Discuss that portion of the population for which nature is not the fix we might hope it to be.
Sure. Well, her complaint was that it wasn't enough time.
Right.
She said, 7 days, it's not going to cure my PTSD. I need to be out here for, you know, months and months and months. And in fact, if you look at nature therapy programs, you know, most of them are way more than 7 days. You know, that sometimes they're 3 months or they're 6 months. So that was her complaint. But a lot of researchers have found that there is a small percentage of people who just hate nature and they're too stressed out by it. They hate the bugs. They are too anxious with the weather. They have had so little exposure, probably as children, that they will never really be comfortable in a natural environment. And certainly this isn't true for everyone who grows up in cities. I've seen some of these, you know, like inner city programs where kids are uncomfortable at first, but then, you know, then they start to really enjoy themselves and start to slowly feel more comfortable in natural environments. But for some people, they're just not going to get there. And, you know, just being near the bugs is just going to stress them out.
And it brought up for me that while we did as people, of course, evolve in nature and our brains evolved at that pace with those sights and those sounds, that, of course, a lot of that adaptation was in direct response to very stressful situations. This, you know, this idea of, you know, survival and food and weather and predators. And so that is stressful. And in the beginning of the book, you mention a phenomenon called it's like poor forecasting or something, where we often will say, I don't want to go outside. It's stormy. It's rainy. It's yucky. It's hot. It's buggy, whatever it is. Like, I don't want to go. But if we make ourselves go, the physiological effects are very beneficial, even in uncomfortable circumstances.
That's right. It's a forecasting error. We have a failure to sort of predict how happy a certain environment's going to make us. And we'll think, oh, we won't be that happy if we walk in the park. And we'll be just as happy if we, you know, walk under a subway tunnel. But in fact, we're wrong. And the researchers have shown that, no, actually, we are happier after walking in the park. So we sort of misjudge it. And then beyond that, we also just, you know, we just don't make it a priority because we don't really understand the value.
And that you bring up in the beginning and in the end, that it is still at this point considered a luxury, not a necessity. And that is an important shift and change that we're going to have to take on as we become more profoundly urbanized.
That's right. And I think as the science becomes more developed and better understood, you know, I think we will come to a place where we realize that actually access to nature is a human right. And it's something that everybody needs. It's not just a luxury. It's a necessity.
So in following up on the early intuition and writings of Wordsworth and Muir and Olmsted and the other poets and philosophers you follow, what have you changed in your life or in the lives of your children since the move to Washington and the public, you know, the research and writing of this book? What have been your ultimate changes?
Well, I got a dog, for one thing. We haven't really talked about animals, but there is a, you know, our part of our connection to nature is also a connection to other species. And, you know, the science is pretty strong there, too, that interacting with animals is kind of a profound and kind of wonderful experience. So I got a dog, and she's a really energetic dog, and she needs to go out into the woods. She loves to go into the woods many times a day. I try to take her at least a couple. And yeah, so I'm trying to spend more time outside. And I've also just given myself a pass from thinking that nature has to be sort of perfect, or that it has to be like a long trip to nature or a pristine trip to nature. It doesn't. Like, I can just go, you know, sit outside in my backyard and get some reading done, or I can eat my lunch in the backyard. You know, I'm making more of an effort to just get outside as often as I can. And the same for my kids. Now that I'd learned about the ways in which being in nature changes our brains for the better, it was time to figure out how to bring these lessons back to where most of us live, in cities. Here are some of the essential take-homes. We all need nearby nature. We benefit cognitively and psychologically from having trees, bodies of water, and green spaces just to look at. We should be smarter about landscaping our schools, hospitals, workplaces, and neighborhoods so everyone gains. We need quick incursions to natural areas that engage our senses. Everyone needs access to clean, quiet, and safe natural refuges in a city. Short exposures to nature can make us less aggressive, more creative, more civic-minded, and healthier overall. For warding off depression, let's go with the Finnish recommendation of 5 hours a month in nature, minimum. But as the poets, neuroscientists, and river runners have shown us, we also at times need longer, deeper immersions into wild spaces to recover from severe distress, to imagine our futures, and to be our best civilized selves.